FNR, Football Nation Radio. The Journos, with Carlos Alberto Diego and The Age's Michael Lynch on FNR, Football Nation Radio.
Streaming football 24/7. It is FNR Football Nation Radio, Australia's first and only 24-hour radio station dedicated to the beautiful game of football. I'm Carlos Alberto Diego, and this is the Journos Tuesday edition with Michael Lynch from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. You can join us on our talkback line and win big. We're offering to our best caller or SMSer a traditional premium pack panettone from our great friends there at Ital. Just give us a call on 9944 9999. That's 9999 9999 03 in front of that if you're outside Victoria, plus 613 if you're overseas. You can SMS us also with your thoughts and comments on 0428 933 345 0428 933 345. The panettone's there waiting for you to ask any questions you want of Michael Lynch. And as I bring Lynchy onto the line, good morning to you, Lynchy.
Good morning. I must come and get my panettone.
I know. We're waiting for you. In fact, Lynchy, we know you love your panettone, so you'll have three.
Oh, well, that's brilliant. three panettones. I'm as fat as a fool already.
Absolutely. We've been feasting on them here, Lynchy, and we love every moment of it, mate. So, but let's get into it. Now, I want to get up to the Sydney Derby. I want to get your thoughts on Sydney FC against Western Sydney Wanderers. I know it was a huge defeat there for Western Sydney Wanderers. But let's talk about Graham Arnold a minute. Does he need to be almost auditioning for the Socceroo job, or whatever he does now after Ange Postecoglou left doesn't really matter? People know that he's in the mix.
Oh, well, I think people know he's in the mix anyway. But, you know, we all know that form is temporary and class is permanent. But we also know that latest form is always the thing that sticks most in people's minds. So it can't help Graham Arnold. It can't help do any harm at all to Graham Arnold's claims for the Socceroo position, that his team is going out and gallivanting around and playing such fantastic football and smashing the bejesus out of their closest rival. I mean, we're 10 games in at the start of the season, and they're 5 points, 6 points clear, 5 or 6 points clear at the top. They've only lost the once, and they're carrying on the way they did last season. They look, certainly in that Derby game, they look miles better than they did last season. And they were pretty good last season, but they just look to be playing with a fluidity and a movement. I mean, admittedly, they were helped by the Wanderers basically being like cones at a training drill most of the time. But you know, you can only beat what's in front of you. And I know they're disappointed. I saw a story my colleague Dominic Bossi wrote yesterday, quoting one of the Brandon O'Neill, I think, saying we felt we should have got 7, 8, or 9, you know.
Well, Arnie was talking about getting 10 in the press conference. Well, so, I mean, this search for perfection sometimes, I don't know, it depends, I suppose, the relationship you have with your players and the challenges you give your players. And he seems to be thriving on the fact there's a lot of competition for places. The team or the group seems to be relatively happy, even not that they're happy to sit on the bench, some of the players, but they're content knowing that there's a, you know, if they train hard and they get their opportunity and play well, they'll keep their spot. He just seems to have that happy mix at the moment of a really, really good team on an individual basis, but also a collective that's relatively content to play whatever role they're asked to.
Yeah, he certainly does. And, you know, it's interesting. And yeah, people say he's dour and defensive. I don't necessarily buy that. What he is very good at doing is setting up a team defensively not to concede. But that doesn't mean that, you know, Arnie's teams haven't been parking the bus, have they? It's not as if they're hanging on and dually winning 1-0, you know, on the break. You know, if you didn't know anybody, or if you didn't know the personnel involved in the push for the Socceroos coach, and that was the first game you saw of Graham Arnold on Saturday night, you'd say, well, why on earth wouldn't this bloke do the job? Mm. He plays great attacking football and his team gains nothing away. So, there's a lot of preconceptions around Graham Arnold, and people say, oh, yeah, but he had a chance in 07 and he failed. Well, you know, those of us with long memories, including some of us who were there at the time, know that, yes, it was a disaster, the 2007 Asian Cup campaign. Arnold had basically just taken over temporarily. He wasn't the full-time coach. It was that interim period between who's hitting, leaving, and Pimperbaek starting. The players did not want to be in Thailand and Malaysia. They more or less hadn't had a break in the summer for 2 years, and a lot of them had reached the end of their tether. And yes, you might say, well, a coach should have been able to galvanise them. But there were some pretty strong players in those days, some with a culture of entitlement who maybe thought they were bigger than the team. And, you know, they didn't perform then. But that was 10, 11 years ago. Everyone changes a lot over a decade. You know, we change from week to week, really, in football, don't we? And a decade, I think Graham Arnold's probably learned a lot of lessons. So to sort of compare him to the Arnold of 2007, it's probably unfair. I mean, let's not forget, in 2007, Ange Postecoglou had just been sacked and couldn't get a job. Mm. He was coaching Wilsey, or 2008, 2009. No one wanted a bar of him, and he was coaching Whittlesey. And then he got a chance with Brisbane Roar after actually rehabilitating himself in a television studio. Because that's what put Ange back on people's radar, because he performed strongly with Fox as an analyst. So Ange changed a lot, you know, in terms of the public perception of him and the way he went about things in a decade. So why couldn't Arnie? I mean, I'm sure you have, Carlos, changed. You're not the fleet-footed Carlos you were a decade ago, I'm sure.
No, the stumbling, bumbling Carlos that I was. But, Lynchy, talking about Arnie's journey, North Sydney, Northern Spirit. Remember Northern Spirit, where he was given that job. He was player coach in the interim, in the early parts of that, and he really didn't want the job. I remember he came back. He was sort of, you know, the owners, or he was one of the owners, I believe, at the time. But they sort of forced him into taking that job. He's a really reluctant coach, and to see his journey as a coach and, again, show what he did on the weekend and the command he has with his team at the moment. And he talks about getting into the subconscious of players and clearing that mind and making them winners. It seems like he's taken his coaching even to another level now.
Yeah, I think so. And you talk about the Northern Spirit days. I remember when Arnie was the player coach, a game at Epping against Carlton in the old NSL. And I think it might have been called off because of the problems with the pitch after half an hour or something. And talking to Arnie then, that would have been, that would have been 18 years ago.
Yeah.
Arnie would have been in his mid-30s as a player coach. He was playing sweeper. At the time, you know, the bloke who'd been centre forward for Australia for a decade. It just shows you what the ravages of time do to all of us and our pace, and the lack that we end up with as we get older. But yeah, look, he probably was a reluctant coach at the time, and it's all sliding doors moments for people in life generally, but particularly in that football bubble. I mean, you know, if Fox Sports had been going quite the way it was in 1999, who's to say that they wouldn't have teamed Arnie up with his mate Robbie Slater?
Mm, absolutely.
And but you know, when there were more than one job available, you know, but Robbie went to work for Fox very early on. Arnie ended up going down the coaching road, you know. It's been a journey for him. And you know, I think, and people forget, you know, he has worked with good people. I mean, he's worked with Hiddink, he's worked with Verbeek, he's been his own man. And I think he's also, in the last few years, put to bed the notion that, do you remember when he took over at the Mariners and coached them and grand finals, two grand finals, and won one? Everyone said, oh, yeah, Arnie doesn't like the pressure, though. He can't handle the pressure of a big club. He likes being in the battler's place and creating a siege mentality and us against them, and that's why he could succeed with the Wanderers, but he wouldn't succeed at a big club.
Mm.
And, you know, he's now proven, hasn't he, over the last couple of seasons that the big club, they may not be in terms of fans as big as Victory and Western Sydney, but in terms of attention and status, Sydney are. And he's proven that he can do the job there as well, you know. And also, I guess you'd say, he's proven that he can sort of bounce back from adversity. I mean, And it's very hard when you're 2-0 up in a grand final with 2 minutes to go to lose it.
Yeah.
Which is what he did with the Mariners. And then two or three seasons ago, do you remember where, before Sydney's all-conquering season, they didn't even make the finals, did they?
And absolutely, there was a lot of talk about him maybe being removed from that job. And yeah. I don't think I've ever seen... He was publicly very stressed and anxious about the way the team was going at the time. So for him to turn... I was going to just talk about that, Lynchy. For him to turn it around the year after the way he did and the way the players responded to that, I think that shows a real great man management. Also knowing what he had to clear out and what he had to bring in. It was just a masterstroke, really, last year, last season.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, last season, he really proved his mettle. I mean, having said that, you know, Sydney were good, but they only won a grand final after extra time in a shootout. This time round, they do look, well, they certainly look miles better than the team they beat in the grand final, don't they, at this point, you know?
So what will it do to Sydney, Lynchy, if the decision made in February means that Graham Arnold will leave Sydney and coach the Socceroos?
If he got the job in February, why would he have to leave Sydney? Why couldn't he just combine for 2 or 3 months doing the national team job with his A-League job? I mean, the A-League season finishes at the start of May. Let's just assume, let's pick a day at random, St. Valentine's Day, middle of February, okay?
Yeah, okay.
Let's say he got appointed then. Well, it's 10 weeks before the end of the A-League season, including the finals. Mm. I mean... You know, he would have, I presume, Ante Milicic as an assistant, and he might bring in somebody else. Why couldn't he have Milicic or somebody else just scouting the European players? He would then be coaching in the A-League, watching every single A-League player who's bubbling under a regular or on the radar while coaching his Sydney team. They've only got one friendly or something, haven't they? One or two friendlies in March.
March, yeah.
You know, I just don't think it's beyond the realms that he could do it for 2 or 3 months, juggle the two, because the national team job, you know, is not going to be all-consuming at that point. I mean, I think there's maybe even a longer-term argument as to about the nature of national team coaching and whether you actually have a kind of an approach like that all the time, but that's a different story and a different debate. So I would necessarily think he has to go in say mid February, and Sydney would need to find a replacement for the following season. But there you go. Do you think there'd be any legs in that?
I mean, Gus Hiddink coached the Socceroos and also PSV at the same time. So I mean,
He did it by remote control from the Netherlands.
That's right. They still got us there, and we still performed credibly over in Germany. Now, Lynchy, Western Sydney Wanderers and Josip Gombau. You talk about your colleague Dominic Bossi. He's been all over this, and it seems like it's a club really at breaking point almost with Josip Gombau and the players coming out and not being happy with the information overload, and you know, fans aren't happy with the demolition of their club on the weekend to Sydney's hands. And there's talk now of the owners not being happy. He's really at that point where he's trying to convince people to have faith that in time things will come good.
Well, come on. If the owners aren't happy, tough luck. I mean, honest to God, you only hired the bloke, you know, 3 or 4 weeks ago. You presumably did your due diligence. You presumably spoke to everyone in Adelaide, where he was for a couple of years. You watched his Adelaide team play. You knew exactly what was going down there. You would have talked to Postecoglou and the national team set up to find out what kind of a guy and a coach he was, and then you hired him.
Yep.
So, I'm assuming that's what they did. And if they didn't, well, more fool them. So I don't think the owners have really got a leg to stand on if they're complaining at this point, right? Mm. The players, well, you know, suck it up, boys. You are employees of the club, and you're getting paid, some of you very well, some of you not so well, but you're getting a start in the game. It's your job to listen to the coach, try and absorb the information that he's giving you, and go out there and perform to the best of your ability, not to sulk if you don't like it. For coaching staff, Gombauer surely went in there with his eyes open. He would have known when he was given the opportunity what was in front of him. He would have looked at the playing list and he would have said, right, I need to make these changes. If he backed himself or he thought the list was good enough to make those changes mid-season, that's one thing. He probably knows now that the list isn't good enough or lacks the capacity to make the changes he wanted to their game plan mid-season now after such a shellacking as that. So he too then has to trim his sails and cut his cloth accordingly and perhaps rethink about the way he does things, at least for the balance of this season. I mean, all coaches do need an opportunity to bring their own players in. I guess from what I've said here, I've kind of criticised the owners, the players and the coach, haven't I? So what I'm saying really is everyone needs to take a big, deep breath, draw a line under the sand after that ridiculous defeat the other night and say, that was a one-off, we can do a lot better, and let's go again. I don't think it's ever time to panic in football, because once you panic, you are completely lost. It's probably never time to panic in life, is it? Because you just lose all sense of perspective. But it is time to have a big, deep breath and look at the situation rationally and say, well, that didn't work. And you know, this story that was put about last week about targeting three of Sydney's defenders, I don't know what that was all about, you know. I mean, it certainly didn't unsettle Sydney, did it?
No, but in fact, he would have unsettled his own team, especially they were after three defenders, and the likes of Michael Thwaite was put on the bench on the weekend. And I think maybe part of the problem is that it's been quite open, the fact that he'll only play players who will adjust to his system. He'll only play players who he feels long-term will suit what he's trying to do. And maybe a few of them feel that the writing's on the wall. Do you expect a few changes, a bit of turnover of playing list in January?
Well, you'd think so. I mean, that's fair enough. He's entitled to say that. You know, I mean, and I assume this is why the hierarchy at the Wanderers signed him. I mean, that's a big job. In Australian football, there aren't many bigger, are there? You know, Sydney and Victory probably, and Melbourne City for different reasons. But you know, Wanderers could have presumably got a number of coaches from overseas as well who would have been very interested in that job, and they chose him. Now, partly that's, I'm guessing, because they were impressed with his vision and they were impressed with the way he wants to do things. So, yes, he will need time, and I'm sure there'll be a big clear out in the January window. And you know, let's hope. I mean, if we could get a loan and transfer system going as soon as January, it's probably a bit soon for this year, but there's been talk of it. You know, that maybe the Wanderers could have that clear out that they need.
It's interesting to talk about the loan system and the transfer system. We had John Didlitzer in, you know, yesterday during Football Extra, Lynchy, and we started talking about the need to start looking at these sort of things. Why suddenly is it on the agenda 4 weeks away from January when this could have been discussed, you know, in the off-season where there's good planning around it, and it's not what appears to be a bit of a knee-jerk reaction maybe to the pressure that the FFA board are under at the moment?
Well, it's possibly that. It's possibly just Australian football, you know. It doesn't think... I think the PFA are the most strategic thinkers in the game by some considerable margin. So they would have had it on the radar, I'll be thinking about it. But there is an awful lot of reactivity about what gets said and done out of FFA headquarters, and they probably didn't address it, even if the PFA brought it up. Well, would it be addressed now? I think there's a very, very strong realisation, even amongst the dimmest of observers, you know, that something needs to be done because attendances are falling, TV ratings aren't great, increased criticism in all social media and traditional and mainstream media, just the dullness, not so much of the product. I think the football's quite good, but the dullness of what the concept of the A-League now is, with its 10 teams, it's never any change, just the recycling of the same old all the time. It's just really flat, and I think there's maybe a belated realisation you know, everyone sees in Europe what a great sort of kick along the whole game gets in the September window, you know, that summer window, July and August, with transfer speculation, and also in January, you know, when struggling teams are able to effect a clear out, bring in players, that fans get hope for a change, managers get a reprieve, you know, to for at least a few weeks to see if they can turn it around with new signings. And it's all part of the theatre and the entertainment of the game in Europe and around the rest of the world. So maybe the FFA have realised, God, we need to do something because it ain't looking great now.
Well, it's just, you know, people are so disillusioned, Lynchy, over a number of things. Like you said, the sameness of the competition. But maybe is the overarching issue with people not going to the games and maybe not watching them, not being compelled to watch a pretty good product, like you said, is it their dissatisfaction generally has come to a point, dissatisfaction of how the game's managed, and maybe the leadership, and whether the leadership itself can recover from this after, you know, this chaos that's happening at the top level. Once that gets sorted, and it will in the next couple of months, hopefully, whether there's a future for people who are running the game at the moment to stay in the game.
Well, I don't think it's necessarily a direct cause. I don't think people sit there in Footscray or in Baldwin or Box Hill or in Balmain or wherever they're living, you know, and say, I'm not going to watch Victory or City or the Wanderers or Sydney tonight because Stephen Lowe is making a pig's ear out of running this game, or David Gallup's clueless, so I'm not going to go and watch Brisbane Roar just to show him. I really don't think that's what's happening. I just think it's a kind of, you know, a disillusionment that's born in part perhaps by frustration at the way the management's not able to sort of develop the game. But it's also just, I think, with the things we mentioned earlier, just same old, same old. I mean, I professionally work in it and I get bored, you know, with the same faces and the prospect of, you know, the same thing happening over and over again. And I mean, I'm not bored where the games start. I love watching the games. And you know, what we do forget, though, there are bright spots. Like this time round, Central Coast are good to watch. You know, they've been a drag on the competition for a couple of seasons, but I saw them in Melbourne on Sunday night cover that game. And you know, I think City were better, but the Mariners were much, much improved, and some exciting younger players, and just, yeah, a team that you could tell were on the rise. So that's exciting. But just, yeah, in general terms, I think there's a staleness. And also, you know, there hasn't been a great marketing push for the game, has there, this season? No. You know, the launch at Port Melbourne, it was very understated and very low-key, and it was explained away as being emblematic of the game's grassroots push this season. Well, that's fine. You can spin that once to explain a cost-saving launch of that nature. If for the next 4 months you are seen to be making a massive push at grassroots level, but you know, I haven't seen that. Have you? You know, you don't see any pre-game or very little pre-game advertising, and you know, the marketplace is much more competitive in the summer now than it was even 3 years ago. You know, you have the kind of rise of women's sport, and particularly, say, with cricket, which is a far bigger kind of national pastime than football is, in general terms. You know, like, people know about cricket in a way that they don't know about football, even if they don't follow it that closely. But Cricket Australia, you know, invests money in promoting and marketing women's sport. It also flies journos around to cover it, which is, you can say, all right, it's buying coverage. Well, of course it is, but it's no different that than spending the money on a display ad. At least if the traditional media are go to games, you're probably going to get something in the paper, aren't you?
Absolutely. And Lynchy, I was going to ask you, Lynchy, the importance of looking after people like the journos. And I'm not talking about, getting you to write stories on something that's not watchable or something that's not interesting. But what part? I mean, I go back to the weekend in the EPL, for example. Jose Mourinho, the story about another Pizzagate going on, causing some fight in the tunnel or some fight in the change room, and the journos were there, and then when asked about it, he's, you know, they're very forthright and honest, and gives the journos something to write. Gives them a reason to be really passionate about what they're doing and get excited about what they're writing. What responsibility do the coaches in the A-League have to excite people like Michael Lynch and Dave Davutovic and Matt Winley to write something more than just a match report? And, I see Warren Joyce, he's very old school, for example, and he's doing a wonderful job there at Melbourne City. I mean, obviously there's cultural issues where it's a bigger job than just winning games, but... he's just flat bat press conference. There's nothing new there to see. Kevin Muscat, he's got a good relationship with all the journos out there, but there's nothing sort of really, you know, headline newsworthy about what he says. What responsibility do the clubs, the coaches have to excite our journos into, writing exciting stuff that they're really passionate about?
Well, I mean, I think they have a responsibility, yeah, to promote the game. Now, does that mean that they need to say clickbait kind of shocking statements? Well, yeah. I mean, you know, that's the easy part for us if they say clickbait, grabbing, shocking things. But more generally, I think they've got a duty to try and give us something to work with. I mean, even if it's just to talk about team changes. I mean, hardly anyone wants to even say a player's injured or they might have to make changes. I mean, often Muskie sounds like David Brent out of the office. Kind of, you know, mind-numbing sort of series of managerial cliches. And you're right about Joycey as well. I mean, although he knows it and he sort of jokes about himself being Jeff Boycott. You know, because he wants to give nothing. His position's a bit... I mean, that club's kind of run out of Manchester.
Mm.
So Warren Joyce's job is basically the coaching and developing the kids. Really, if they could have Brian Marwood or somebody from Manchester doing the press conferences on Skype, they probably would prefer it, you know, just because that's where most of the decisions are made. But, yeah, look, in general, I think... I mean, I've dealt with, you know, Ernie Merrick never really used to want to say anything much or give much away. John Ben Schip I always found good.
Yep.
Because maybe it's because he was Dutch and that sort of forthrightness. John Ben Schip was one of the very few coaches you'd ask him about the opposition and what do you expect or think from them. And he'd just happily talk about they're good, they're bad, they're playing well, they're playing poorly, where their weaknesses are. You know, he would talk about that sort of thing, and as a result, I used to find those stories much easier, better, and more interesting to write because it gave you something, you know.
Yeah.
And so I do think there's this kind of and players are very much the same. There's a lot of players who just don't want to say anything, and you know, there is an element of this that the game is financed by media. Not all wholly, and certainly not by Fairfax or whatever. We don't pay to cover the game. But in general terms, the atmosphere and the interest in the game is driven by traditional media who cover it, and obviously Fox Sports who pay large amounts of money to telecast and broadcast the game. And if in the end the participants make themselves so boring and so uninteresting and give you nothing... I mean, there's often times when I haven't bothered going to one of those stand-ups. Not often times, but a few times. Because I just know, right, it's a choice between me doing two things, you know, maybe having another potential interview lined up at the same time. And I'll often say, well, there's no point. They're just going to ramble out cliches. And I'd rather do this other story, maybe where I talk to agents or I talk to people around the subject and write a more interesting story because they'll tell me more. And if in the end the protagonists make themselves so boring that the media can't be bothered, and that's not a general thing, but you could see a point where if they keep managing themselves to the point where they say absolutely nothing, well, what hope are the fans got?
Yeah, and with them sending audio out of what's said anyway, I understand why you wouldn't go Lynchy, because, you know, it saves you a trip. You get the audio anyway to have a look through it or have a listen to.
The thing is, all these coaches that were, I'm sort of criticised. I mean, you know, I know them now. Yeah. I know them over the years. I can ring them up. And, I mean, off the record, they'll be incredibly engaging and really good and give you lots of insights. If you know, I mean, I have that kind of relationship. I suppose they've been around a long time. They're terrific like that. But it seems like in a public environment, they're paranoid about saying anything lest the opposition take something out of it, as if the opposition don't know everything about you anyway.
Yep.
Yep. You know, I mean, really.
That's right. And it's really interesting, you know, the big managers around the world, Jose Mourinho is a classic. He understands the value of providing that, yeah, you talk about that click bait grab, something that the journos just feast on. And I don't know whether, obviously we don't do it well here in Australia, but is there any club that you've come across in the years you've been involved who did it well? And that means that they understand the value of giving you a grab that you can write a story on, something that's something to do with the game. It's not something that's manufactured, but something to do with the game. But they understand, or a coach. Who was the best? I mean, you talk about John Van Skip, but...
I think going back over my time in the A-League, I personally always liked dealing with John. Now, that's not a view that all the journalists shared. I mean, a lot of them thought he was a bit too rambling, but I found if you wanted to sit there and talk for an hour with John Birdship, he would do it. You know, he wasn't... I mean, nowadays you get all these PR blokes who stand in the corner and after about 7 minutes go, that's it, no more questions. Birdship would just keep going, because maybe it's that Dutch culture thing where, you know, they just want to talk endlessly about tactics or whatever. But I found John engaging. Postecoglou, you know, and it was very good, particularly when he used to give those briefings. I mean, the set-piece press conferences, very few of the coaches like doing that with the TV cameras there, and they try and get that over as quickly as possible. But Ange, when he was national team coach, if you were away in Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan, wherever you were, you know, the day, 2 days before the game, there'd be a handful of travelling media. There's usually only two, three or four. And he would sit down and have a coffee for an hour, half an hour, and brief you about how he's going to play, what he's going to do, where the strengths of the opposition are. And on the proviso that he didn't come out until, you know, game day or whatever. He was very good like that, you know. And I do think, you know... There's got to be sort of more of that, really, you know?
Yeah. Let's take a break, Lynchy. You need a bit of a rest. We've gone for 40 minutes straight without a break, mate. But it's been riveting stuff. Let's take a break. And when we come back, I want to talk some more about the A-League and some of the young players that played in the weekend's games, and also some of the other incidences. Maybe some of the players some of the coaches that might be a bit under pressure at the moment. This is The Journos with Michael Lynch from The Age and Sydney Morning Herald here on FNR Football Nation Radio.
FNR Football Nation Radio. The Journos with Carlos Alberto Diego and The Age's Michael Lynch on FNR Football Nation Radio.
Streaming football 24/7, this is FNR Football Nation Radio. It is The Journos with Michael Lynch from The Age and the Sydney Morning Herald. Now, Lynchy, Let's go to the Melbourne City Central Coast Mariners game on Sunday night. And, of course, it was a game that Melbourne City won. I think they had enough chances in the first half to deserve that win. Central Coast came back in the second half. But I want to talk about Nathaniel Atkinson. Did a bit of research on the kid. He played a really good first-up game there on his debut. And I thought, well, you know, we've seen enough of these young guys to know that some of them just burst onto the scene, have a couple of good games, and then go back to the youth team. But everyone I speak to talk about this guy being a sublime talent, and he's been around and people, he's been on the radar for a little while. He's from Tassie though, Lynchy. How many of these kids have we got around Australia that no one's found yet?
You probably think there's a fair few. I mean, this is a whole other program about junior development, and more to the point, the pathways through which kids get found. And it does seem a lot of the time if your parents have got the money, you're far more likely to be part of a program through which you can be found. That's the first requirement, isn't it? It seems these days, rather than just pure talent, you know. But that, as we said, that's a different story. Yeah, there's probably a lot of diamonds in the rough around Tassie. There's no professional A-League team down there, is there? So they're probably, you know, some good kids to be found down there, and fair play to City for finding this lad. He looked terrific. I think, you know, I wasn't doing Johnny Warren medal votes on this game, and I would say that this boy, though, he would have been in contention for at least one vote, I would have thought, on debut. And now, his first half in particular was excellent. Mm. You know, he showed very few nerves, got straight into the game, skill, pace, game sense, strength, technique. You know, he had a terrific game. And I think, you know, Warren Joyce made it clear at the start of his time in Melbourne that, yes, his job is to try and win the A-League. And I think the key performance indicator for City is probably to get into the Asian Champions League. Mm. But he's also, a big part of his job is to unearth and develop and bring on talent and kids. And you know, he's sort of put his money where his mouth is. I mean, he's only 10 games into his tenure, and he's given this kid a debut, and he had Daniel Arzani on the bench, and Braden Crowley came off the bench. So that's three of the youth team that pulverised Melbourne Victory's youth team 9-2 the previous weekend. And I went out and watched their youth team on Saturday out at the CFA, and they basically made, I think, 9 changes from the team that beat Victory so comprehensively. They put a lot of the younger age kids in there, the bottom age of that youth group, the 16-year-olds, and they still came from behind and beat Perth 2-1. You know, they're obviously doing something right at City, and I actually think this is an issue for Melbourne Victory, who, you know, still train in a public park. I mean, if you're the best 15-year-old, one of the best 15-year-olds in Melbourne, and City and Victory come knocking at your door, unless you're a Victory fan and have a compelling reason to want to go there, you just look at the infrastructure and the setup, and you say, well, wouldn't I go to the CFA? Mm-hmm. You know, it's a much better setup than what it appears to me that what Victory have got. And if they continue with this disparity in resources and infrastructure, you could see that City will probably end up getting better kids, and they can always sell the dream of the Premier League pathway. We know it's a remote, remote dream, but, you know, Aaron Moy making that jump has really been a brilliant marketing tool for Melbourne City in terms of selling the dream and the pathway. I think there's a few more on that City conveyor belt that we'll probably see before the end of the season, you know. And Victory have got some good kids themselves. Mm. I mean, you know, Christian Theoharis in particular is a boy who's excited people. But I think if we come round to discussing Victory at some point, which we will, I'm sure, that'll be an element of the conversation there as to when and if these kids get a chance. Now, look, will Atkinson play against Sydney? That'd be a big call, wouldn't it? Manny Muscat's back. I mean, he got a game because of the need to reshuffle the defence. I thought he'd be on the bench. Mm. I didn't know if he'd start. I thought Ruan Tongik might have actually got a start, but he didn't. He sat on the bench for that whole game. But that was his first call-up to the first team this season as well. So you'd think that Joyce may temper discretion, the valour with discretion here for the game against Sydney where the kids are concerned. But he might not. I mean, he's a coach who's constantly said, I will play players on how they perform at training and in the games, as Tim Cahill found out. And, he may say, no, you had a great game, kid. Bruce Kamau's back again. Sorry, Bruce, this boy played brilliant. He's staying in. He might well do that.
And all the news is that the minute he walked in the door at City, Warren Joyce noticed Atkinson. He noticed that he was a special talent. It was only because he went off on, I think, young Socceroo duty or something like that, where he lost him for a while and he had to come back and, keep on working on him. But, Leach, just on the academy bricks and mortar that Victory don't have, that they own, that City do have, I know I was talking to Ian Robson on the victory night a couple of months ago, and I think on that day they were given the news that federal funding wasn't coming through to help them build the academy. I think they were looking at Footscray Park near Victoria University for people outside of Melbourne. That's more in the western suburbs, inner western suburbs of Melbourne. And how it was such a blow for them not to get that federal funding. But for a club as big as Melbourne Victory, what are they waiting for? I mean, the investment that they need to make is going to be huge, but it's for decades to come, for centuries to come, if the club, you know, is there to stay forever. You know, I'm a bit disappointed that a club the size of Victory, who only just recently, I think, announced the first loss for a long time, haven't invested in something to at least match what's happening with the Citigroup there at Melbourne City.
Well, I couldn't endorse your words more strongly. What is it with football, and not just football, with sports teams in this country? Mm. Everyone expects the taxpayer to fund them into everything.
Yep.
I mean, you know, sports clubs, you don't pay the taxpayers a dividend when you make a profit, do you?
Mm.
So why on earth do they expect us to fund stadia and infrastructure? I mean, personally, I think the money would be better spent on schools, hospitals and transport myself. And if you're a big club, I mean, and you know, if you've got some heavy hitters, they've made money, as you say, or broken even all the way through. They do have one of the country's largest home builders, don't they? As a major shareholder. I mean, he'd know a thing or two about knocking up structures quickly and efficiently, wouldn't he? Mario Bjarzen.
Absolutely.
Metricon Homes.
Yeah.
I mean, why don't they just get on with it? They say, oh, it's not easy to find land, it's not easy to find a place in the inner city. Well, don't go to the inner city.
Yep.
You know, Melbourne City aren't in the inner city. They found that tranche of land way up there in Bundoora in the north. Victory could presumably find something similar in the south of the city, in the outer suburbs, or the west, or the east. You know, they always talked about them having a big reach down, you know, towards Dandenong and Frankston and Cranbourne. Why wouldn't they go there then?
Mm. I agree. I just think that Melbourne Victory should be a club that should be ahead of everyone else in every aspect of the game, and I think they've fallen behind in that infrastructure.
I agree with you. I think in many ways, Melbourne City are ahead of them on almost every metric except crowds, which clearly Victory have got far more fans. But part of that is because of the advantage of incumbency, where they got the first crack at it. So Victory are miles ahead of them with fans, and obviously with success on the pitch, where they've won three championships and have been the most successful club in the history of the league, along with Sydney. But in all those other metrics that we've just discussed, infrastructure, youth setup, all that sort of thing, City are obviously, I think, fair way ahead at this point, aren't they?
Mm. Now, Litchie, the game on Friday night, Melbourne Victory versus Adelaide United. I mean, people talk about Melbourne Victory, you know, they might be at that point of crisis. I mean, that's a talking point. But Adelaide United, we can't ignore the fact that with nine men, they hung on at the end. Paul Izzo had a blinder. Issa, what a player Issa is. And there's talk about him getting his citizenship and maybe being available for Australia for the World Cup. I don't know. He was such a leader for that club. Just a terrific win by them.
Yeah, we'll talk about the game in general first, if you like. Yeah, I mean, Adelaide were good, and I don't think I've ever really seen 7 or 8 minutes of stoppage time with one team having to hold on with nine players. I did see a game once at Bramall Lane a long time ago where Sheffield United had one sent off and Portsmouth had three sent off. Yeah. So that ended up 10-8. But this was 11-9. And Adelaide, the Reds, did brilliant to hold on with just the nine men. I mean, it would have all perhaps, though, been a very different kettle of fish if Berisha puts the penalty away before the interval and makes it 1-1 half-time. Is it a time of panic at Melbourne Victory? No, I don't think it's time to panic, but it's certainly time to, you know, as I said earlier, we discussed the Wanderers. I don't think panic does anybody any good, but it is time for a big think and a reassessment, and time to be bloody bold and resolute maybe at the selection table, and some of the bigger names who are not really delivering, maybe give them a spell on the bench or give them a rocket and say, you've got, you know, one more chance, lads. Otherwise, you're going to be left out because there's something not right there. There's a lethargy. I mean, Kevin Muscat was asked in the post-match press conference if there was going to be a shake-up next week, and he said, "I know what you blokes mean, you want me to drop players and bring in kids." He said, "No, I still believe in the squad I've got and the talented players I've got here, and the spirit in the dressing room is good." He insists. Well, you know, you have to take someone at face value. You're not going to say, "Well, you're a liar, kid," are you? You know, if he's saying that, that's what he believes, and then you will make a judgment on the value of his words over the next week or two, when the results will tell the tale, you know. But I know there's a lot of clamour from fans, and there's a lot of people who would like to see some fresh faces there. I've been prepared to give them the benefit of the doubt for quite a long way this season because of the disrupted nature of the season that Victory have had. And I don't think it's fair to smash them completely because of that. You know, they lost key players in Mark Milligan and Troisi and Barbarossa. So players you expected to be key players anyway. I don't think Troisi and Barbarossa are really, you know, delivering that much at this point. But they have lost them off and on for most of the first 6-7 weeks of the season. And the biggest problem, I think, from that point of view, has been tactical continuity and the setup continuity. Mm. If the players aren't there, they can't be training with you. You can't work on team structure and team setup. And then when they come back, you have to forget what you did last week, bring these blokes back in. They play a week. It's not quite right because they haven't been training with everyone. The result ain't great. Then they go away for another week with the Socceroos or whatever. And the process has been repeated probably for 6, 7, 8 weeks, you know? And it's really only now, the last couple of weeks, that they've been able to get those guys in without them going away. And you know, they had a win in Perth and a win in Wellington, you know, as well as that, obviously, that those losses in Newcastle and Adelaide subsequently. So they're kind of, if you like, two from four. They're batting at 50% in this period, which isn't great, but it's not dreadful. But it does need to improve greatly. And obviously, Kevin Muscat's at the end of his contract at the end of this season, and you know, he wouldn't want to be going into contract negotiations having either failed to make the finals or just limped in fifth place or sixth place, would he?
Are you surprised, Lynchy, that they haven't locked him up? You know, nearly halfway through the season, or a third of the way through the season, and someone who's led you to, you know, success over a few years now, not being locked up, is that Kevin Muscat's decision, or is that the club's decision, or mutual? What do you think?
I'm not sure whether it's Kevin's or the club's. I think it's a good decision. I mean, I think people, you know, lock in managers sometimes a bit too soon. I mean, you've got to know your man, you've got to know your character, you've got to know what you want and where you want the club to be going in the future. If you're going to lock a coach in, maybe they are just going to suck it and see, wait till the end of the season and see where they go with Kev. Maybe they felt Kevin Muscat might be in the frame to be part of some kind of Socceroos setup. He's going down the future, not necessarily a head coach, but in the national team setup in some way. So maybe they decided, well, let's just wait and see how that pans out. Maybe they want a completely fresh start. I mean, they're in a tricky situation because Kevin Muscat is Melbourne Victory, isn't he?
Absolutely.
He is the constant. He is the guy. He was the first player Ernie Merrick signed virtually. He was the man who came back from England. He gave them a kind of identity. Other players signed for the club because Kevin Muscat was there. He was a fantastic leader on the pitch, a brilliant captain, an excellent player. I mean, obviously, he had his high points with a few sort of incidents that people remember. But in general, Kevin was a fantastic player, proved he could play in midfield as well, led them to two titles. So that's a pretty big legacy. And then as an assistant coach, he's had 4 years as a head coach. He's taken them to two grand finals, won a championship, a premiership, been the only coach who's ever taken them beyond the group stage in the Asian Champions League and won an FFA Cup. That's a pretty significant body of work in 4 years. So, you know, so if they were to get rid of Kevin Musker, I mean, that is a massive, massive cultural decision. In some ways, it's hard for the club. You know, it'd probably be easier for them if Kevin said, I want out and I'm going to walk. But you know, maybe it is time for all parties to look at the future going forward. Kevin's, what, 44? I think he's 44 now. You know, if he's going to move on to other jobs in management, maybe this would be a good time for him to leave on his own terms if he's got something else lined up. But you know, it's a difficult one for Victory. Were they the ones to want to get rid of him? Because they are basically, you know, it's not quite Totti and Roma, but in A-League terms, well, it's the A-League equivalent. Is there anyone? Terry McFlynn, I suppose, was at Sydney all the time. Terry was never the player or the figure that Kevin was, you know, in Melbourne. I can't think of any, can you?
Not off the top of my head, Lynchy. And if you can't think of it, I think I'll give up trying to think of it. But, mate, we've got to leave it there. Well, it remains to be seen. I think there's a lot of respect there between Kevin Musket and the club. And whatever happens, if he is to go, it will certainly be done in a respectful way, I reckon. But, Lynchy, great talking to you again, mate. We could talk for another 2 or 3 hours, but I know you've got work to do. And we've got a couple of other shows to do too. But always a great pleasure speaking to you every Thursday, every Tuesday, mate.
I know, I must come in for my 3 panettone.
It's all, mate, we'll give you 4 if you come in. Good on you, mate. Thanks, Lynchy. Mate, that's Michael Lynch, the legend that is Michael Lynch, writer for The Age and also the Sydney Morning Herald here on the Journos Tuesday edition. That brings an end to the Journos for today. You can podcast the show on iTunes and SoundCloud.com. So until this time tomorrow, we've got Jonathan Howcroft from The Guardian Australia here in the studio. May you have a great day in football.
The Journos on FNR, Football Nation Radio. We'll